Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Masella.
And I'm Margaret Flint.
Well, Margaret, we're well into the political convention cycle now. The GOP meeting in Cleveland, Democrats in Philadelphia. As expected, there are some significant differences in the party platforms and many issues, including healthcare.
There was some talk of repeal of the Affordable Care Act at the Republican gathering, but the Democratic platform, they're calling for an expansion of the health law, including a move towards a public option for folks 55 and older. We heard about that back in the beginning of the ACA legislation, I think. And the president has issued his own ideas for revising his signature health legislation. He's also talking about public options for health insurance, especially in parts of the country with little or no competition and higher costs for consumers.
The president issued a special communication on the Affordable Care Act in the Journal of the American Medical Association, saying with a number of years of experience with the ACA under our belts, we've learned what works and what needs improvement. He said that Congress should revisit a public plan to compete alongside private insurers in areas of the country where competition is limited.
And we read just in the past few days that average costs for each American now surpasses $10,000 per year, so the cost issue remains front and center. He also called on lawmakers to get to work reining in the high cost of pharmaceuticals and urged the 19 states that have refused to expand Medicaid coverage for their residents to do it. And while the idea of a public option has gained traction in Hillary Clinton's campaign agenda, still a heavy lift politically. No surprise there.
No, there isn't. And in the meantime, we have to recognize that more than 20 million Americans have gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and that is a significant accomplishment.
Well, I think we just have to agree that there will be big changes probably coming after the new administration takes place, whosoever it is, and we won't really know what's going to happen until the results of the November election are in, both in the presidential contest but in the congressional races as well.
And something that all consumers will be experiencing more of in the future is having their complex data, including genomic information, being stored in a way that can be utilized for accelerating health research and mined for data that can lead to improve population health, Margaret.
And that is something our guest today is very passionate about. Dr. Anil Jain is the co-founder of Exploris, a data sharing system in the cloud recently acquired by IBM Watson Health that allows for storage and data analysis of massive stores of health data, all in the pursuit of advancing scientific discovery.
Well, that will be an interesting conversation, Margaret. And Laurie Robertson also stops by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org, who looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please contact us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Anil Jain in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Health officials are tracking what they believe may be the first case of Zika actually acquired in the U.S. The patient from Miami-Dade County had not traveled outside the country. The source of 1,300 or so infections charted in the U.S. so far have come from travel abroad. A health worker in the West may have contracted the virus from handling a sick patient. That is being confirmed. Meanwhile, the virus has been largely spread throughout much of Central and Latin America, as well as the Caribbean, via the Aedes mosquito, which is starting to make its way towards U.S. shores. Zika can be transmitted sexually from males to females primarily, but also from females to males. While symptoms in most cases are mild and flu-like, Zika's greatest danger lies in its connection to serious birth defects in babies. Thousands of cases of microcephaly having been recorded across the hardest hit regions from Brazil to Puerto Rico. Another virus struck during the recent Republican convention in Cleveland. Dozens of participants from the California delegation were affected by the highly contagious and virulent stomach flu, norovirus. It's known to spread quite quickly in large social gatherings. The lack of access to affordable dental care impacts a large sector of the U.S. population, especially the poor. According to an article in Kaiser Health News, 108 million Americans, more than a third, lack dental insurance and therefore easy access to dental care. The Department of Health and Human Services has provided $156 million in grants to hundreds of health centers across the country to assist in providing some coverage. Adult visits to dental offices fell 9% between 2006 and 2012. The Kaiser Family Foundation study found even when they had coverage, cost of care remained a barrier. About half those adults with private coverage, 49%, had a dental visit the last year. And for those on Medicaid or children's health insurance programs, the numbers were worse. Only 20% of adults insured by Medicaid or CHIP and 17% of uninsured adults saw a dentist in the past year. And from the Everything Old is New department, the rising threat of antibiotic resistance is creating more impetus for clinicians to seek other alternatives for prescribing. Complex issues like chronic sinus infections often lead to multiple antibiotic courses. The initial infection is often shut down only to return with a vengeance. A study out of Southampton University in England looked at the effectiveness of home remedies such as inhaling steam, as well as flushing the nasal cavities with a saline solution. The study looked at 900 patients with chronic sinus infections, dividing them into four groups: those continuing their regular treatment, those getting just steam inhalation, those doing nasal irrigation with a neti pot, and those doing both steam and irrigation. Those in the irrigation group alone were most likely after 6 months to have reduced bouts of infection and were least likely to need antibiotics during that time or even to require over-the-counter remedies. Researchers believe a simple rinsing of the nasal cavity with a solution of warm water, salt, and baking soda helps flush out most of the infection-causing pathogens. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Anil Jain, Senior VP, Chief Medical Officer, and co-founder of Exploris, a cloud-based healthcare analytic platform recently acquired to help form IBM's Watson Health Division. Dr. Jain served for 16 years at the Cleveland Clinic, most recently as Senior Executive Director of Health IT, where he oversaw several innovations, including creating interactive dashboards to monitor meaningful use of electronic health records. An internist, Dr. Jain is a diplomat of the American Board of Internal Medicine and a fellow of the American College of Physicians. He's a graduate of the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine and completed his residency at Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Jain, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark.
You're at this incredible intersection of innovation in healthcare, driven by two major factors in this country, health reform and dramatic advances in technology. And your story seems to be a perfect example of the confluences of these forces. You and your colleagues at Cleveland Clinic have been working with electronic medical records since 2001 and saw the need to develop cognitive systems that could better aggregate health data from multiple sources. Maybe you could walk our listeners through the origins of Exploris and the gap you sought to fill.
So, like many organizations, the health systems that were early adopters in the electronic health records really focused on making sure that they were implementing and configuring the EHRs in a way that would be most conducive to the practice that the typical internist or specialist would do within their hospitals. The idea that EHRs were collecting vast amounts of data and data that simply just didn't exist on the paper-based world was not something that was easily translatable to use cases that the various silos of the organizations would always discover. So at the Cleveland Clinic, what we tried to do was create a focal point by which those folks that needed data, like, for example, folks that might need data for enterprise performance improvement, or those that were doing quality improvement, or in clinical research or health services research or running a clinical trial, they were going to different corners of the organization asking for data. And as the EHR, when we were first starting to use it, became a central focal point for patient care, it also became obvious that much of the need for the data for different groups, parts of it could be supplied by the EHR if the data was combined with other information sources. So what our group simply did was try to bring together all the different disparate data sources that one would consider to be important for those activities and to create a simplified mechanism. And much of it was people and process to be able to aggregate disparate data together and then be able to very quickly start to have a dialogue with that data so that a group could get the information they needed at the right time. So whether it was for understanding whether an entire panel of diabetics was getting all their care needs met, or whether there was medications that were affecting the liver or kidney. So there was lots of opportunity when you start bringing data together. And I think the Cleveland Clinic was an early pioneer in both the EHR implementation And then what we can do in a secondary use way for analytics for both quality improvement and clinical research. And our group simply made many of those things a little bit easier to do, and hence when we spun out some of that technology and process, it was simply because we were being asked by many organizations, you know, how do we bring that capability into our shops? But it's not a surprising idea to focus on adoption of the EHR before you start focusing on the secondary value or the secondary use that that EHR data might provide in different aspects of what we do. Now, when you start thinking about the idea that we can start deploying some of this capabilities to other health systems that were embarking on very similar strategies around trying to balance the needs of data for quality improvement and the needs of data for clinical research became a very easy story to tell.
Well, Dr. Jane, you say that Exploris was founded on the principle that you had to be able to capture the five V's of data. Tell us what those five V's are and what's their relevance to the mastery of data analytics in healthcare, which now has so many complex sets of data streaming in from so many different sources.
It's a great question, Margaret. Really, the three V's are very commonly known as volume, the velocity, and the variety of data that comes at us. And in healthcare in particular, those three V's, the volume, velocity, and variety, are directly related to sort of the rapid adoption of health IT that we see within the four walls of a hospital system, but also out in the community, where there is a large amount of data being generated by the electronic health records and the other ancillary information systems and all the discrete data that's related to it, all the lab values that come in through the tests that we do on our patients, and all the metadata that are all part of the stream of information that comes at us. Fortunately, most clinicians, we really only see the relevant pieces at any given time, but in those databases, there's lots and lots of data. That's where the volume piece comes in. In terms of velocity, we're seeing a significant increase in the amount of data being generated by sort of devices and processes that we sort of took for granted as being not typically data intensive, but now it's difficult to walk into any hospital in the United States without having a bed, a smart bed, that's generating lots and lots of data, or automated blood pressure machines that are generating readings on a regular basis. And that velocity of data puts a unique challenge on the traditional hospital-based data systems that really weren't designed for the velocity of how some of these newer technologies are interacting with us as clinicians. Think about some of the new devices that we're implanting in our patients, whether it's the automated defibrillators and pacemakers. And so the velocity of data that we see in healthcare is increasing significantly. The variety, the third V, is simply relates to the fact that many of us see medicine being practiced in a very local way. And many of us really, really do think that medicine is somewhat local. And no matter how much we think that health information is standardized, there are some nuances. And the variety of data, it even differs among providers within the same organization. The other two V's are very interesting. One is the variability. Even when I have variety and volume and velocity, how I do things day to day may change. Medicine advances at a phenomenal rate. The amount of medical knowledge that we are dealing with, and some people say every 18 months, it doubles. And so there's variability of how we do things, and that variability introduces a challenge when it comes to understanding it. And then the final one is value. There is a lot of data out there, and if we're not careful, we will start to pick and choose and bring everything in. And in a resource-strapped sort of environment that we all live in and breathe in, it's important to understand the value of what we're trying to do, the value of the data that we're trying to bring in at the end of the day. So that's where the five V's come from. We barely have technical interoperability among our systems. And every physician and every healthcare provider is different. And therefore, we need mechanisms to deal with those differences and account for them.
And Dr. Jane, I'm wondering if you could talk about your partnership with IBM Watson. As I mentioned earlier, Exploris is a cloud-based healthcare analytic platform, which was recently acquired to help form IBM's Watson's health division. And I think the public might know Watson by their winning of the game show Jeopardy. But I think for those of us who know Watson, know that description narrowly defines the work capability and horizon of their work. And interlay the sort of role Explorers, as you've described, this treasure trove of 50 million people playing in the Watson ongoing development.
So, as you said, we were acquired back in April of 2015, really to form the Watson Health Unit. We were acquired by IBM to create this first division that they've created in 20-some years. When Watson beat Jennings in Jeopardy, the idea that a augmented intelligence or a AI platform like Watson can learn, it can understand, and it can then reason and give answers to questions, or in the case of Jeopardy, give questions to answers. Much of it has to do with what you use to train Watson. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Jeopardy, they use commonly available books and journals and encyclopedias. And if we're going to use this sort of augmented intelligence platform, this question answer in healthcare, there's two different types of knowledge bases that you need. One would be the journal articles and textbooks. And certainly that is a key part of Watson Health, which is the ability to ingest large amounts of journal articles and textbooks and to be able to learn what others have spent years and decades perfecting. But the other part of it is what's happening in the real world. It's one thing to say that in this clinical trial, using this particular blood pressure pill lowered the blood pressure by a certain amount. But it's another thing to say that when you actually see that 50 million patients' care being delivered and those medications being used, what really happens? And so for Watson to be able to read all that information generated by the Explorers platform and to understand the differences between knowledge-driven insights and data-driven insights in the real world is a critical piece. It's how we all learn, too. We'll go through medical school learning from textbooks and journals and observing on rounds and perhaps even practicing, but we continue to practice, and that practice is a critical piece for any kind of augmented intelligence or AI system. And what Explorers does is it basically provides that raw material, that fuel for Watson to do that. And once Watson does learn something, how do you deliver it back into the field?
Right.
And so Explorers becomes that platform, along with the other parts of Watson Health, like Phytel and Truven, that make that ability to go from the bench to the bedside much more effective.
Well, Dr. Jane, the Cleveland Clinic certainly has a big impact. And we actually had the Cleveland Clinic CEO, Dr. Toby Cosgrove, on the show not long ago, talking about the clinic's innovation model, really designed and created to support entrepreneur clinicians like yourself. Can you share with us some of your experience with the Cleveland Clinic innovation team and how that made this work possible?
Absolutely, Margaret. I think the Cleveland Clinic Innovations team was a little bit like the iHarmony, if you will. It was essentially played a vital role in connecting me with those that had a significant set of experiences that would help us scale what was really a prototype and something that worked very well within our four walls in order to scale it up to a level in which it becomes a fully functional business entity with a business model. There's only a few things like the clinician innovators like myself could have approached. We could have gone from grant to grant, or we could try to create external validity to what we were creating, going through a tech transfer process like Cleveland Clinic Innovations that connected me with a number of individuals that were looking for interesting ideas that simply needed capital and really some operational experience outside the academic health center sort of setting. And that's how I met the sort of the entrepreneurs that became the CEO and the president of Explorers, through that process of connecting me and my group with entrepreneurs who had passion for being in healthcare and, more importantly, had experience in running companies. So we need to sort of create the three legs of the stool if we're going to innovate outside the four walls. And so Cleveland Clinic Innovations provided expertise to connect the dots. In so many ways, I'm very grateful to Cleveland Clinic Innovations, not only for connecting all the dots, but also making sure that even after they stayed very engaged and very much a critical piece of our success. Even now with the IBM acquisition, Cleveland Clinic and Cleveland Clinic Innovations are a strong partner for us.
We're speaking today with Dr. Anil Jain, Senior VP, Chief Medical Officer, and co-founder of Explorers, a cloud-based healthcare analytics platform company, which was recently acquired to help form IBM Watson's health division. Dr. Jane, you seem to have a sort of an endless set of applications for the Explorers platform, better clinical integration, at-risk population management, outcome measurement and patient safety, and in particular on the last topic, medical errors having been cited as the third leading cause of death in this country. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners how your cloud-based system of data storage, data analytics, helps improve patient safety as well as other outcomes.
One of the areas where Explorers and Watson Health is absolutely committed to making sure that we can get on top of is, can we make sure that all the data that's important about the patient, all the information that's relevant is available at the time that a decision is being made? As you know, healthcare is fragmented in the community, healthcare occurring in the hospital's four walls, in the emergency rooms. So the first step is to make sure all the information is there so that some of these medical errors that happen because of having fragmented information simply just get reduced. The other types of medical errors that occur and that we see occurring have to do with making sure that the information that is out there, that is in journals and textbooks, is made available at the time that a decision is being made with the relevant context. And so part of the Explorers Watson Health story is, can we make sure that all the information from the various different sources are first filtered through particular characteristics of the patient and then presented to the specific person making the decisions? To give you an example, the typical provider, when they see a diabetic with high blood pressure, might get anywhere up to 10 alerts. In many cases, those alerts may conflict with each other, and the tendency for most of us who see that volume of alerts is simply to ignore most of it. So part of the medical error issues have to do with just having too much information out there and not enough actionable insight. And Watson Health and Explore certainly are trying to fix some of that. The other thing that often happens with medical errors is that we tend not to know how we should classify some of the outcomes. I think we need a better job of capturing outcomes and making sure that we know what really happened. And part of that is to get at all the data, not just the clinical data, but the process data about how the providers behaved within the electronic health records and the ancillary systems, but also what was the patient's response? Did the patient actually do what they needed to do? It's all about the entire cycle between when a decision gets made, how it got made, making sure that we're leading the provider and the patient to make the right decision with the right information.
Well, Dr. Jane, I'd like to look at another area where I just think there's tremendous promise, and that's increased participation in clinical trials. Researchers can now reach into a massive database of patients to gain access to a great deal more potential participants. And talk to us a little bit about how Explorers is really helping to advance research through this much greater participation in clinical trials.
So one of the things that Explorers and Watson Health is doing is making sure that information about clinical trials and what clinical trials a patient might be eligible for is made easier for the provider. At some of these large healthcare systems, there could be hundreds and thousands of clinical trials occurring. And how is anyone expecting the primary care provider to really be able to offer the patients the right clinical trial? So one of the things that we're working on is something called Watson for Clinical Trial Matching. We're working with some academic health systems where we're able to use Watson's ability to read, looking at clinical trial protocols in the cancer space, and saying which of these patients are going to be most eligible for these different trials. And we're starting in oncology because it really is a shame when a patient doesn't get offered a clinical trial or a protocol that might be life-saving. You know, we're also going to be branching onto the metabolic areas, neurosciences, but really our first step is to make sure that we've got a good sense of how this is going to work around oncology and some of the areas where I think there's a certain very reasonable expectation by every provider and every patient that every patient should be offered a clinical trial when appropriate. The other area is asking the simple question, does every single new bit of innovation and insight need a randomized controlled trial? Mm-hmm. Or can you use the data that's already been accumulated? Can we use that information to really understand what happens in the real world and to start to create these almost virtual clinical trials or hybrid studies where we look at a little bit of the real-world evidence and then hone in on what we really want to study so we can make the randomized controlled trials a little bit less expensive and still get the same benefit to society from those trials? all the way from matching the right patient to the right trial to using the data to really re-engineer the way clinical trials are conducted in the first place.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Anil Jain, co-founder, chief medical officer, and senior VP at Explorus, a partner with IBM Watson Health, providing a cloud-based data analytics system for healthcare. You can learn more about their work by going to explorus.com or follow them on Twitter at hashtag IBM Watson Health. Dr. Jain, thank you so much for the work that you do and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mark.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Barack Obama said there have been huge drops in the murder rates in cities like New York, Los Angeles, and Dallas. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said, quote, violent crime has increased in cities across America. Which is it? We'll score this one for Obama. The long-term trend is a decline, not only in the murder rates per population, but the total number of murders in the cities Obama mentioned and nationwide. The same goes for violent crime. Trump was referring to a recent year-over-year increase in murders in some cities. Let's take Dallas as an example. Murders there peaked in 1991 at 500 for the year, but they totaled nearly half that, 231, in 2000. In 2012, murders in Dallas were lower yet, 154. The murder rate, offenses per 100,000 in population, dropped significantly too. But Trump pointed to a New York Times article on an uptick in 2015 in the number of murders in several cities, including Dallas, as compared with 2014. All told for 2015, Dallas saw a 17% increase in the number of murders from the year before. But as criminology and statistics experts told us, we can't discern a trend from a few years of data. The violent crime rate, which includes murders, aggravated assaults, rape, and robbery, for the nation also hit a peak in the early 1990s and has been declining since. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. As the saying goes, music soothes the savage beast. And according to a recent study conducted by Queen's University in Belfast, Ireland, there's some empirical data to back that up. In a first-of-a-kind longitudinal study, children suffering from a variety of behavioral and emotional conditions who were exposed to music therapy in addition to traditional therapies had far better outcomes than those children in a control group that offered traditional therapy without music therapy.
It's not a matter of them being given music or choosing music. They actually make music along with the music therapist assisting them. So the idea is for them to express themselves through music.
Lead researcher Dr. Sam Porter said there's been anecdotal evidence that music improves mood in children and adolescents as well as adults, but his study revealed just how effective the music therapy was.
Our primary outcome was an improvement in communication. Now, there were two very interesting secondary outcomes, levels of depression and levels of self-esteem. And in the secondary outcomes, we found a statistically significant difference between the control group and the intervention group.
Dr. Porter says in the group given musical therapy, it showed over time more interaction with their surroundings and a better response to the traditional therapies as well.
I mean, that's one of the marvelous things about music therapy. There are no side effects. It is not a dangerous therapy to get kids involved, and it is a productive way of getting kids to improve their health. So it is just such a good way and a harmless way of doing things. So it's really satisfying to know that it's also an effective way of doing it.
The study was conducted in conjunction with the Northern Ireland Music Therapy Trust, which sees the promising findings as an incentive to incorporate this relatively low-cost, non-invasive therapy into standard protocols as an additional tool to enhance outcomes for the youth population, which often suffers negative side effects from powerful medications. A simple, targeted music therapy approach showing great efficacy in improving outcomes for young patients with minimal side effects and lasting benefits, now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.